is Joakim Noah of the Chicago Bulls, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin. And let's see how the ball's gonna bounce today.
Playoffs?
Tim Gallagher, basketball historian, with another appearance on the Chicago Bullseye. It's always great to have him. A lot to talk about today. We want to continue our discussion in this part two from last week's discussion. Let's start out, Tim, a little bit on the coaching carousel. Frank Vogel fired in Indiana. I'd like to start out with that specific coaching change. I thought it was an unjust firing. I think you could look back the last 5 years and you could make a solid argument that Frank Vogel has done more with a less talented roster than Tom Thibodeau did. I really believe that. I think Indiana, you know, they had Paul George, Hibbert, you know, to a lesser extent, but some decent players, but I think the Bulls have had more talent than they have in the last 5 years. What say you?
I agree. I've been really impressed with Frank Vogel in terms of not only his X's and O's, but just his demeanor and poise and how he manages the game. And, you know, Larry Bird obviously is an intense competitor, kind of in the Jerry West mold of, you know, someone in the front office that is a very no-nonsense, we're here to win, no excuses kind of a person. So I can't imagine having Larry as a boss would be a load of laughs. So the fact that he's been so successful under that kind of a situation, and as you mentioned, the roster other than Paul George, and I think we're seeing – we'll get to the Heat and Toronto series here in a second, but you see teams like Toronto without a Paul George level star, right? I don't think DeRozan or Kyle Lowry is at that level, and that's what it looks like you need to have to win at this time of the year, this deep of the playoffs. So in a way, I'm complimenting Vogel for getting the pieces together to that puzzle, right? With George Hill, he got some great mileage out of Lance Stephenson. This year at center, he had, you know, Mahimney and a little bit of Miles Turner developing. So, you know, a young roster. And Monte Ellis is a little bit of a loose cannon, a talented guy, but, you know, is that a guy you can really trust on a team that's going to go deep in the playoffs? So I think with the pieces he was given, he did a great job. And I don't know if you saw Larry Bird's press conference. There were a couple of interesting things to note about that. Was I think in his own style, Bird was complimenting and very high on Frank Vogel's coaching abilities, and basically said Frank will be fine and he's going to get a job, you know, quite promptly. He just felt, Bird felt like 3 years is kind of the, in his mind, the limit of how strong a coach's voice is going to be in the locker room and running a team. Now you could argue with that, with, you know, exceptions to the rule like a Popovich. But when you think about it, the short lifespan that most of these coaches have these days, Bird might be onto something. And I saw some things about Larry Bird's own career, and you think of the Celtics and the dynasty and the stability of that franchise, and certainly it was with Red Auerbach, but I double-checked, and Bird had 4 different head coaches during his career. So,
wow.
So it was a little bit of a carousel, right? And so you had Bill Fitch initially, then Casey Jones, then Jimmy Rogers, and Chris Ford. So I think just in my mind, looking back, I wouldn't have thought that there was that much of a revolving door with Celtics head coaches under Bird, McHale, Dennis Johnson, you know, Ainge, Parrish, you know, with that group. So I guess based on Bird's experience, he may be onto something there. One other quick little sidelight, Jimmy Rogers, who was Bird's coach for a while there, you know, he was an assistant for the Bulls, you might recall, with the Phil Jackson teams. And so got a couple championship rings as an assistant with the Bulls, and also was an assistant under Bill Fitch earlier on with the Celtics. And both Fitch and Jimmy Rogers were the coach and head coach when Phil Jackson played at North Dakota as a player. So kind of a, you know, I love those family tree kind of things. So I saw the name Jimmy Rogers pop up and led me on that mental trail of a coaching tree. But anyway, so yes, Vogel, I think there's already talk that he's in line for the Knicks opening as a potential strong candidate there. You know, I think of the candidates that are out there right now, Vogel, you know, I think David Blatt obviously got a really unfair situation there in Cleveland. Kevin McHale, I don't know if Kevin McHale wants to coach again. Bird did mention that obviously they're so close from being teammates for so long that he didn't think that the mix of them, you know, McHale coaching under Bird was the right kind of situation. So even though he admires Kevin, he wouldn't think of bringing him in as the Pacer coach. You hear Nate McMillan's name out there. That's another possibility. I think he's probably worthy of another chance. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I guess at the moment we just have the Rockets, Knicks, and Pacers jobs that are open. But, again, hard to imagine the Pacers are going to find somebody that's going to do a better job than Frank Vogel. But according to Bird, they just need a different voice, a different viewpoint.
Yeah, I completely agree with your opinion on Vogel, definitely. I mean, I thought he was a great coach.
Well, and obviously Memphis is open, too. So Jaeger was fired, and the Kings gobbled him up in no time, which that's another guy that I think a lot of the same sentiments you just echoed about Frank Vogel, you could say about Jaeger at Memphis. I mean, if you look what he did over the last couple of years, and this year, you could argue their injury situation was even worse than the Bulls, and they had a 42-40 record, oddly enough, the same record as the Bulls. And in the West, kind of a rare circumstance, a 42-40 record still got you in the playoffs. So, but it'll be interesting to see with the Kings. They gave him a long-term contract, but we all know that the Kings' ownership is a little unstable. And DeMarcus Cousins is probably no coach's dream as someone to be your franchise player. But I thought about Jaeger at Memphis, and he had some personalities. He coached Lance Stevenson, Matt Barnes, Zach Randolph, Tony Allen. And I didn't see any issues or dissension or troubles with that group. So he obviously knows how to command a team, and I'm sure he'll somehow make it work with Cousins. The other couple of recent changes were Scott Brooks going to the Wizards, which I almost see that kind of as a lateral move in the sense that Randy Whitman and Scott Brooks, I see them as kind of similar coaches in terms of style and success they've had. I mean, obviously Brooks did get OKC to the finals with Durant and Westbrook, and Whitman didn't get quite that far. But, again, I think it was just time for a different voice for the Wizards. And, of course, there's some speculation that maybe Durant would look at the Wizards since he's from that area originally. Although I heard someone else say if Durant was that fond of Scott Brooks would probably still be coaching the Thunder. So I think there's some validity to that.
Good point.
Yeah, so let's talk. Oh, sorry, interrupt you there.
Well, one last one was Luke Walton going to the Lakers, which we'd have to go back to a podcast from maybe almost a year ago that I predicted that one day Luke Walton would be the coach of the Lakers. I didn't know it would quite be this soon, but I think that's the right move for the Lakers to make. And I think it's a little ahead of schedule for both of them. I think Luke would ideally probably like to stay at Golden State and be around the magic that's going on up there, from Curry to Draymond to Klay Thompson to Steve Kerr to having Jerry West as a consultant in the front office. But the Laker job probably isn't going to pop open every day. And obviously Luke's ties to Southern California as a former player for the Lakers, I'm sure Jerry West advised him on the decision. And even though Jerry West is up in Golden State now, I think he probably still bleeds a little purple and gold and probably felt like Luke was as good as anyone to kind of take over the mess that's the Lakers right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the playoffs. Start out with incredible performance from Curry, who, you know, I can't believe he came back this early after the injury and knee injury and, you know, previously the ankle injury. He comes out, has a pretty horrific game up until overtime, and in overtime he puts up 17 points. What were your impressions of the game? Do you think that one, that series is pretty much over now going forward? But where does that rank in one of the all-time great playoff performances?
Boy, and as we keep saying with Curry, just when you think you've seen it all, he's doing unprecedented things. I've used that word quite a bit describing Golden State and Curry in particular, but 17 points is the most points any individual player's ever scored in an overtime in the history of the league, regular season or playoffs. Are you kidding? And a guy coming back from injury. And the other interesting dynamic from that game was Sean Livingston got kicked out of the game. And usually Sean Livingston's one of the more mild-mannered players. He competes, obviously, but not someone known to go off and get teed up or get ejected from a game. But oddly, that kind of ushered the way to get Curry more minutes and get him into that game. And turned out to be a vital move in terms of Sean Livingston's exit. Enabled Curry to step in there and play. So obviously I thought Golden State's going to win this series anyway, but certainly having it be 2-2 and going back home and, you know, uncertain about Curry's health and status, you know, boy, in a matter of minutes that all just changed, right? And for a while there, it looked like Portland was matching them, you know, an eye for an eye with McCollum or Lillard hitting long range shots, but Golden State just persevered and came through again. And then, of course, Curry was named MVP of the league, which is not a surprise, but it surprised me to see he's the first unanimous MVP in the history of the league. Again, I can't tell you how strange it is to say in the history of the league so many times about a player and a team, right? We really shouldn't take this for granted of what we're seeing here.
I am shocked that he was the first and that Jordan never managed to win a unanimous MVP vote. I'd like to find anybody who did not vote for Jordan in those years where he won an MVP and just, you know, slap him silly with a dead bass or something. I mean, I am just furious that someone would not understand the greatness of Jordan and not give him that honor. But congrats to Curry. He deserved it. And I'm glad no one screwed it up. You know, he deserves MVP.
Right, right. Well, and your reference to Jordan and who couldn't have voted for Jordan in some of those years, it's kind of like how we're probably taking LeBron a little bit for granted too, right? And I know Cleveland had some ups and downs during the regular season, but they seem to really be clicking now. But, you know, the fact that we're taking LeBron a little bit for granted, I know there was some of that when Jordan played. So when someone like a Karl Malone or Barkley would have an exceptional season, maybe get their team to the finals, that was seen as more valuable than what Jordan was doing. Not that Jordan's greatness wasn't noticed, but it was kind of taken for granted.
I'm going to go back and research it. When they won 72 games in the 95-96 year, and he won MVP, I got to find out who had the call to put a vote in for someone other than Jordan. Because when I heard that, that's the first thing I thought, wow, first of all time, I didn't know that Jordan didn't win a unanimous MVP. And, it just makes me angry just sitting here thinking about it. You know, like, come on. They won 72-10. He was the best player on the team by far. And you're not giving an MVP vote? I don't even know what to say.
Right. Yeah. And one other quick little point about Curry. And just watching that Portland-Golden State series, and you could make a pretty strong case that those two teams have the best backcourts in basketball, right, in the NBA. And if you look at the colleges where those players came from, so for Portland, Damian Lillard from Weber State, C.J. McCollum from Lehigh, Klay Thompson from Washington State, and then Steph, of course, from Davidson. So just think of those schools. You know, there's not McDonald's All-Americans ever gone to or probably will ever go to those schools, right? So it just shows you that, you know, the path to NBA greatness isn't necessarily going to Kentucky or Duke or Kansas or Michigan State, right? It's really intriguing.
Great point.
Those are the origins of those players.
Great point. What do you think about, let's go over to the Heat series. I want to get your opinion on that. That game's now 2-2. That series not 2-2, and the Raptors really, I think for the vast majority of the playoffs, have really suffered at the hands of their two best players, Lowry and DeRozan. I think have had some really horrific moments so far in these playoffs, especially when it comes to shooting the ball. Yeah, it's 2-2 that here in round two. Where do you see that series going and ending up?
Well, on our last podcast, I very strongly said I felt Miami was going to win the series because of coaching and because of Wade. And that was before Whiteside got hurt. And Valanciunas is hurt, too. So there's a couple of pretty significant injuries. But as you saw, both teams were playing small ball. But your point is about Lowry and DeRozan, I think those are two very good examples of a very good player and then that line to a great player, right? So I think those two are very good players, but you can see a great player, even with a guy with the age and mileage on him of Dwayne Wade, he's taking over that series, right? He's taking over games where Lowry has struggled and DeRozan, I thought, really struggled. So it points to the game where certainly as I'm watching it, okay, DeMar, this is where you take over. Kyle, this is where you take over. And it's just a little above their abilities. Not that they're not outstanding players, but, you know, when we talk about, well, who are the top guys in the league, and, you know, when we were talking about where does Jimmy fit in, Jimmy Butler, right, in terms of the upper echelon, right? And so in games and in series like this Miami-Toronto, it shows you where that line is and what players haven't quite gotten there or may never get there.
Completely agree. I thought Corey Joseph would probably had a better game than both of those guys. It's just so frustrating to see a guy like DeRozan and a guy like, you know, to Kyle Lowry, who have had a ton of great pub. They obviously had a good season, leading their team to, you know, the second seed in the East, and just playing awful, I think, for the most part down the stretch. There's no way they should have lost that game yesterday. You know, I think they had an 8 or 9 point lead with about 6 minutes left. And, you know, you just need one of those two guys to get hot and make something happen. And you're right. The best way to put it is Wade just took over and said, I'm going to win this game. And that's the difference between Wade, who even at this advanced age is an elite player or a great player, and these two guys who are, you know, pretty good. You know, I don't know where Jimmy lies on the spectrum there. Probably, though, after watching these two again in the playoffs, I think, overall, I'd probably have to put him ahead of these.
Right. Now, and I have him, I see a player like Paul George at a level above a Lowry and DeRozan, right, even though the Pacers got eliminated. But I thought how well he played, and we just talked about the supporting cast at Indiana is certainly, there's not even really a second gun, in terms of, you know, maybe it's Monte Ellis, but boy, that's kind of a drop off, right, in terms of from Paul George. You know, I kind of compare what's happening with Toronto to Atlanta, right? They've got some very good players, but you saw how Atlanta struggled mightily against Cleveland, and I think Cleveland is
absolutely
really good. I mean, they're clearly a superior team, but I thought what Atlanta was really lacking was leadership or a superstar player. I mean, you know, I love Millsap. I love Horford. You know, I'd like having those guys on my team. Korver, you know, is certainly a skilled player at what he does, but you know, you can just see without that superstar that it's hard for teams to win in the playoffs.
I got to hammer this point home because I watched every game of that series, and you know, Korver is probably one of the best role players potentially ever in the NBA. Those games were basically 4-on-4. Cleveland made a conscious decision, hey, you know what? We're going to take Korver out. We're going to guard him out 40 feet. Doesn't matter. We're going to have a guy on him all the time, and he's going to be right in his grill. I don't care if he's 5 feet beyond the three-point line. So that all the space left there is for, you know, the guys like Teague and Horford, and, you know, to take advantage of, especially Teague, because you've got more space there now to work with, and that benefits a player like Teague. And they weren't able to step up and make it happen. It's just a real condemnation of that team, the rest of the guys on the team. You put it best. It's just a huge line between great players and guys like Teague and Horford and, you know, DeRozan and Lowry. They're all in that group. And then you got the great ones, you know, with Curry and obviously we've kind of and you know LeBron, et cetera.
Right. So even though I didn't expect Atlanta to win that series, I thought it was a pretty uninspired effort from them. And then Teague in particular, I don't know if he was hurt or what, but Teague just was pretty lifeless. You know, they did have some spark when Schroeder was in running the point, But obviously it's frustrating when you're getting beat handily. But in particular, I thought Teague really kind of lost interest out there, it seemed like. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with Atlanta as well, because if teams like Memphis and Indiana are blowing things up after having reasonably successful seasons, considering the hands they were dealt with, injuries and just what talent they have, I'm wondering if Budenholzer is long for Atlanta, especially if you hold the Larry Bird's, after 3 years, change it up and get a new voice in there.